So the third layer I'm trying to point out is this, what I call the biological substrate. Because we still are living things. I mean, we're still biological entities. But we're kind of stepping into the territory that says, well, wait a minute. Since my life depends upon, in a sort of a broad sense, state of health, which is like, if you look at all the major nations of the world, the number one economic pressure point is the cost of health care. That's it. It's the top of the chart. And so many different entities from all different realms of industry are sort of focusing on how to change this around, how to preemptively prevent the cost of health impacting what they do. So there's a lot of pressure to really pull this genomic referencing out of the box and sort of push it into the outside world in a very aggressive way. And for some good reasons, some for bad reasons, but nonetheless, that's kind of what's around the corner. So what I'm suggesting to you is we're heading into a realm that says, let's say you're a mother, second trimester, as a function of access to your health care, it's required that a specimen be removed, your genetic makeup is tracked out, so by the time the baby's in the birth canal, we already have the entire genome mapped out. We know precisely what marker points to look for, and we're going to prescribe a proteomic regimen from point of birth onward. And that proteomic regimen becomes part of the data footprint, just in the same way you have a, so like a credit reference footprint, and you have a spending pattern footprint, you have a travel pattern footprint, you have a communications footprint. Now you're going to have a biological footprint, and the whole thing sort of merges together and tracks along its virtual environment. So you have a realm where you have integrated biologicals, you have a data, sort of ubiquitous data grid, and you have process inception essentially working in real time. Timeline for that, 3 to 5 years. But the pieces are sort of here, as I speak. Now, will it really happen? I don't know, but it's a matter of policy as opposed to can it be done. But now, of course, I know that a lot of folks are looking at all this stuff and they panic and they freak out. They see the film The Matrix and they think this is where we're going, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you see the Bill Joy version of this. And, okay, fine. So they think of like some giant horrible things about to happen. They visualize an Armageddon type of the big rock hits Earth and life is extinguished. Well, okay, that's one model. But there's a bunch of things that people are still kind of scared of. Mostly folks know about HARP? Okay, great. And think about HARP. Now, look, I spent many years in the National Lab System, and I sort of understand what this is about. In a very rough sense, it actually was born for a good reason, even though some people will question why it exists now. The real reason it was put into practice was because during the SALT treaties, the major failure point for both the former Soviet bloc and us was the what's called the nuclear triad communication chain of command. In missile silos and in bombers, you have a very, very specific chain of command. There's a whole complicated procedure. You have to get certain codes. Everybody in the crew has to agree to the codes. They go through a whole series of checks, and then you finally say, okay, it's launch time. In the submarines, however, you didn't have it at that time because there was no way to have a unified communication link that was inviolable. And in fact, it was only on the submarines where the commanders had the autonomous authority under certain conditions to go ahead and initiate launch independent of a chain of command. And both sides had this problem, as it were. So as a way to work out a solution to this problem, both sides agreed that they would demonstrate a viable communication system to their submarines so that the entire system of that triad would be unified with the same chain of command. So HARP was originally designed as a very, very high-energy radio transmitting platform that could create a certain special characteristic of wavelength and so on, so that submarines could come up to a certain distance below the surface, trail behind this big, long, essentially a wire, and be able to transceive information back and forth. We also had other things like line of sight laser, and I won't go into that right now. But the whole point was that's how HARP got this point. HARP was born as a tool to prevent global warfare. So, I mean, it started, you know, with a well-intended concept. Now, since that time, it's been used for things like, well, what they call ionic heater, to change weather patterns and to cause all other kinds of things, which I won't go into either for the moment. But in other words, it was a kind of an interesting thing that was born in good intent. Now it's being sort of experimented with to see what other things can be done with this. This giant radio transmitter is still being used to this very day. That's one world. Then a different world says people are beginning to freak out because they're actually seeing things like neural prosthetics and biochip implants and the ability to have cybernetic modifications of the human body, and they think, oh my gosh, this is this horrible trepidation we're about to step into. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. What if these things were in fact the only way that we are able to step up to a realm that requires an ever more robust ability to process knowledge? That is to, in a sense, enhance who we already are to adapt to this next evolutionary threshold. what if these cybernetic modifications are in fact the only path possible to get to this next step? I'm just offering this as a kind of a two sides of the coin kind of thing. So if you look at this, let's just have a quick look at the process dynamics of evolutionary system failure versus the Armageddon trauma singularity model. In fact, the evolutionary system failure model is the exact opposite, the inverse. It's not one big thing suddenly happens and everything dies, no. What it is, however, though, is a system of very complex interdependent processes, which if you were to work this out in kind of like an option matrix, they have sort of nodes, if you will. The nodes can be clustered into certain categories of process, and then if you determine certain probabilistic aspects, criteria being met, okay, then it sort of leans in a given direction. But what I'm suggesting to you is that we're sort of in the middle of this chart. We're kind of like here. We're right about there. Now, could we get here? Yeah, we could, but we haven't quite determined it. We're about here. So I keep trying to suggest to folks that rather than sort of go back in the shell and back away, rather process this and see where it might fit from your perspective. So again, the idea is that problem space, dissolution space, interface boundary is highly perturbed. It's very bumpy. It's not a flat thing with one penetration point. And more importantly, it's a many-to-many problem space driver. It's many different interrelated processes, not just one boundary point. All right. So to take the sort of big picture look, this is like the overview as I see it, and probably most of you would agree. The current process by which current life support capacity of the biosphere may be suppressed into eventual system failure mode. Top of the list, highly centralized, megalithic, predatory manufacturing industrial processes, energy systems. In fact, we've had these discussions here at Tesla many times. Tesla himself, in fact, was trying to maybe change this. He figured that maybe it was possible to harvest the Earth's electromagnetic potential and produce that as an energy system. I think he might have been right, actually. I can also tell you that having worked for the Department of Energy myself personally on different kinds of solar systems and all kinds of other things we were working on, are we necessarily required to have this gigantic, top-down, megalithic power distribution system? I say no in many cases. And in fact, guess where this really goes? It goes right back to nanotechnology. Why is that? Because nanotechnology is a material system. Think about this for a minute. Anybody here familiar with superconductivity as a concept? Something there? Just real roughly, superconductivity says that normal conductors, you have to sort of drag the electrons through the material. There's molecular friction. I won't bore you too much on physical lecture, but the point is the atoms through what's called de Broglie motion kind of wiggle. They wobble back and forth, and the shells and the outer valences kind of get looser and looser as they heat up. If electrons are sort of being yanked through a conductive material, that causes more friction, more heat, and the shells get even larger and sloppier. So resistance goes up, heat goes up, and electroconductivity goes down. In superconductivity, this all goes away. In fact, the electrons fall to the material. There is no internal friction at all. Now, superconductivity has been around for a long time, decades. But up until fairly recently, it was confined to extremely exotic materials. I myself worked on a system like this many years ago. In those days, it was sort of hair-thick, niobium wires jacked in titanium around a gigantic magnetic bobbins and then dumped into a vat of liquid helium. It's not very practical. You're not going to have one in your house tomorrow. But, a few years ago, Dr. Stefan Chu from Stanford, who shared the Nobel Prize, developed a sort of a non-crystalline superconductor. It involves metallic doped ceramics, and we won't go into a big discussion, but let's just say it's done. You can actually buy these things as Edmund Scientific. Well, take this step further. Think of nanotechnology as a reversal of engineering, because engineering really says you have to confine what you're designing to the available materials and manufacturing technology of the day. In other words, the materials sort of trap you inside this very small box of possibilities. Nanotechnology kind of reverses this. It says, no, I can invent a new molecule or a new molecular system to suit whatever design thing I have in mind. And I can tell you, without any reservation, that superconductivity is a big ticket item. In the military world, this means extremely robust computing in a very small package. It means a whole new class of sort of avionics and electronic infrastructure and so on. Now, could this be replicated into the outside world where all of us have electric cars? I mean, in other words, look, electric cars today, it's a lovely idea, but frankly, they're very inefficient and not that good. It takes a huge amount of energy to actually make them do what they do because they have to pull the energy off the grid. And the batteries aren't that efficient. Okay, fuel cells are kind of interesting, fine. But think for a moment if all of a sudden the motor's efficiency were increased by 10,000 or more. You don't need a, three tons of batteries to make the motor do something interesting. It might be something on the scale of a solar reflecting panel and a very small battery. That's what superconductivity could offer as a process. And I would submit to you that had superconductivity been pushed as an agenda, perhaps with a nanoscale technology focus to make it more viable, could we be out of the loop of the sort of petrochemical system that we're in now? Maybe not today, but certainly in a handful of years. And I think quietly behind the scenes, this is already being done. But are you going to buy this tomorrow? Probably not. But again, this is what I'm trying to sort of connect the dots with. It's not the technology you should be shrinking away from. Rather, you should be rushing toward it. Because this is the stuff that will get us out of things like having to go to global war to fight over territory to dig oil out of the ground that we probably don't need in the first place. Yes. Please, no, that's right.
How come human beings have evolved in such a way that what you discovered first, like oil and petrochemicals, is the absolute worst thing that we could discover? Why did we invent superconductivity before we invented it was easy, it was
yes, exactly right. Thank you. And that, no, that's the answer. It was there. I mean, look, I use the seed bottle often to describe human anthropological morphology. It goes as follows. A seed has a certain internal resource base. It gets germinated, it's in the ground, it can hang out there for a little bit before it finally, as last result, has to push out of roots and leaves up the top so it can start photosynthesizing. We are like that seed. Right at the very moment of inception when the roots about to pop out and the leaves are coming out. In other words, we have the luxury of using very sloppy, clumsy, simplistic, Rube Goldberg-ish technological solutions to solve our momentary problems. We weren't challenged. We weren't at the evolutionary event horizon of having to probe into the world of superconductivity in the first place. Superconductivity was a sort of obscure academic interest, but it had nothing to do with daily life because this stuff was right there. The oil was there, the minerals were there. But, we're heading towards a world where it's not going to have that luxury anymore. And the wars that we have fought, that all countries have fought, the whole idea of predation as a sort of a profit-bearing industry, that's not going to work anymore. But we have the luxury of simply going for the simplest answer first, a commoditizable solution to what's now become an otherwise difficult problem.
How do we know that nanotechnology is one of those simple things?
It could become that way. That's the Bill Joy model. But I'm trying to suggest an alternative perspective. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Right? Instead, I want to suggest it's a baby. Let's nurture it and see what happens. I'm not guaranteeing anything. In fact, I'm flipping a coin up here, spinning around. But at least the coin's spinning. It hasn't landed yet. So maybe we can affect probabilistically where it lands. That's the idea here. And let me walk a step further, if I may, since you asked the question. In 1976, we turned lead into gold at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. I saw it. I was there. Now, this has been the alchemist's trick for centuries. It was the defining moment how to determine was an alchemist doing something interesting. But why is that really relevant? Think about this. Almost every major nation that's ever existed has defined their net worth value on the bullion, on the hard assets they could determine value of their currency. Now, of course, in today's world, we don't live that way anymore. We have a debt leverage economy, essentially. But up until maybe turn of the century, that was the de facto standard. And think also that in most cases, whether it's the United States or Europe or whoever else, we've carried on expeditions, we've launched wars, we've invented all kinds of crazy ideological reasons, but essentially the idea was to go take over some of those territories and get the mineral that we're looking for, especially rare earth minerals. And we'd go to any length, we'd support any dictator, any crazy, wild, strange government that we'd otherwise never tolerate. We'd look the other way just because they had cobalt or something buried in the ground. We went by cobalt. Okay, fine. Well, where does nanotechnology fit into this? Here's an answer. The reason the lead to gold thing was interesting, but not really, outside world dollars, was because it cost $30,000 to produce a gram of it. Using electromagnetic systems, an accelerator, with power off the grid. You see what I'm going with this? Now imagine, for instance, if instead the power cost almost nothing, which it could if you had a superconductive system facilitated by the nanotechnology that could produce the materials that make this material in the first place. Now all of a sudden you take a source material, I don't care what the heck it is, you bombard the nucleus, you break it up and it recombines as a new atom. And for those who aren't familiar, and I apologize, standard physics, there's something called a table of nuclides. You can take any element in the chart, almost any element, and you look at what's called the decay pattern. An isotope is an element whose nucleus is unbalanced. It has an imbalance between protons and neutrons. So it ejects both particulate and electromagnetic wave disturbance up until the point where it can finally resolve to a more balanced form. So as it goes through a transition from a stable to an unstable back to a stable element of a different size, it goes through a series of what are called Dauber elements. And in fact, there's a table called the table of nuclides that shows this sort of like a staircase, if you will, as it descends into a different element type. So theoretically, you could take any element, I don't care what it is, take some sorus metal, for instance, blast its, you know, nucleus, let it reorganize itself and become another metal. Again, the limitation is the energy cost to produce that transition. Let me try a different experiment. In the world of gemstones, especially colored stones, and I used to actually trade gems as a hobby, I know the background, there was a point in time where certain colored stones, as they're called, were very valuable. Sapphires and rubies and other things of this nature, emeralds and so on. Well, that market's kind of wobbly right now. The reason is that a bunch of physicists, in fact some friends of mine, got into the enterprise of being able to grow these minerals in a furnace. And they got so good at it that you couldn't tell the fake ones, if you want to call it that, from the ones that were dug out of the ground. In fact, the way that professional gemologists would do this is they would look at the stone under a microscope and look for what's called inclusions, you know, certain flaws that are in the stone. So they got real clever, including using what are called doping materials, and they could actually grow a fake better than the original. And in fact, there's a pair of women who are now in Texas. They're very, very bright women. They worked out through physics, and they figured out how to grow perfect rubies, complete with inclusions and flaws. And every year, they get a phone call or two from somebody over there, usually from the Asian world, that says, we'll pay you whatever you ask if you can grow us a batch with the inclusions. And what they do is they put a special fluorescent compound so that under normal light, you can't see it, but if you put it under a certain frequency of light, it suddenly glows a different color. That's how you can tell the fake ones from the real ones. And so they, as an ethical consideration, they've always guaranteed that they would always include this fluorescent compound into their grown stones. But every year they get a couple of calls from somebody in Taiwan or Hong Kong, wherever it is, saying, we'll pay you whatever it is if you grow a batch for us without the included fluorescent material. They've never done it. They've been very ethical. But what I'm trying to suggest to you is that this is a very sort of temporary, artificially contrived stock measure. The whole idea of having colored stones that are some kind of reference point for a value commoditized that in currency terms, that's kind of gone. So where are we heading? We're heading towards a world that says metals could sort of follow the same path, if it were allowed to happen. Just kind of tossing that up as an idea. Okay, so the next point I want to get to is acceleration in the consumption of non-renewable resources. Well, that's what we were just talking about. And non-renewable resources actually come out of surprisingly strange areas, because most people think of this in terms of digging rocks out of the ground, smelting out metals, or cutting down a bunch of trees, you know, without replacing them and so on. But there's a whole bunch of other things that are going on, which also represent a sort of non-renewable, sort of monodirectional process mechanism that says once you've used up the critical components of process X, somebody becomes more expensive and more difficult, and now we have to like invent a new market model to create the whatever it is. I'm suggesting to you that those market models themselves sort of fade into the background if you're not commoditizing something that has a fixed lifetime to it. And this is a very difficult economic model for a lot of people to sort of come up to pace with. So the third one is this irreversible alteration of the ecosystem, soil, oceans, and atmosphere. Well, that's kind of obvious. But the next one is this increased dispensation of hazardous materials, pathogens, and mutagens. And this is something that's very interesting indeed, because we're living in an age now where never before have we ever seen such a concentration of artificially contrived compounds crammed into every nook and cranny of our existence, which cause cancer, which cause all forms of health problems that have never occurred in our history. Even though we've managed to survive all the usual things, you know, bubonic plague and smallpox and God knows what else that we might run into because of biologic warfare, for the most part, as a species, we kind of evolved past those evolutionary test thresholds. But now we've kind of invented a new realm that has never existed before. And I'll give you a couple of reference points. When I worked at GT Lenkert, which is across the bay here from San Carlos, they tore down the entire plant. This is a huge, like half a mile under the roof. They had chip manufacturers, circuit board manufacturer, they had the whole microsystems lab there I worked there. Down the street was Fairchild, but he had a bunch of other foundries as well. They all got taken away. EPA came in and said, look, this is too hazardous, you know, you gotta move somewhere else. They went to Mexico for the most part. The point is, a friend of mine from UC Berkeley, who's an entomology major and now he's an environmental scientist, they actually went to the very site I had once worked at. What's there now is a parking lot and a shopping mall and some condos. 40 feet into the ground taking core samples. And the soil is very clay, it's like compressed clay layers. 40 feet down, they were pulling up chemical sludge, I guess for a better choice of words. When they were running through the chromatography equipment, they had to constantly recalibrate their equipment because they could not believe what the equipment was telling them. The concentrations of various kinds of solvents, cadmium, benzene, antimony, you know, name an element, somewhere in the fab process, it was there in such quantity that it was like off the scale of their equipment. They couldn't even believe their equipment was telling them. This is like one tiny example of just an enormous collection of these kinds of things all over the world. I mean, Eastern Europe probably has the worst example right now. But the point is that as a physical system, we're being exposed to stuff we've never encountered as a evolutionary component in our sort of referencing to where we're going to be going next. At the same time, you have epidemiological processes which are occurring, again, on a scale that's never happened before that we know of. And in fact, are anyone here familiar with the book called The Coming Plague, written by Larry Garrett? I mean, I've talked to Larry Garrett at length, and we have a long discussion on occasion. The point is, she did a very beautiful job. She wrote this big, thick book where she charts out in extremely fine detail human migration, changing evolutionary processes. The whole idea that the ecology of a given area changes radically overnight because the whole area has been clear-cut and turned into cattle fields or whatever the thing might be, which causes, of course, environmental changes, which causes these various organisms to mutate to new forms, to go to new hosts, and of course people are traveling in ever wider, more sort of granular fashion, which means that these diseases now spread and cross-mutate in a way that's never happened before in all the history that we know of. And we're just beginning to get the edge of how to really begin to work with this process that we're sort of being confronted with as we speak. So people look at all this nanobiology stuff that's going on, you know, being able to reorganize life at the microbiome and think, oh my God, we're inventing Andromeda strain. Well, maybe. But it may also be the only way we have to deal with this new kind of biological mechanism that we've already contorted far beyond what its natural evolution would have consisted of. So again, it's knowing what the tools might be useful for as opposed to being imperative. Yes, please.
I would say that I think the pioneers would disagree with you.
I know. But I willingly admit that my ideas are not meant to be controversial, but I simply want to offer an alternative perspective.
I'm suggesting what they say is you can use nature to clean up some of the metatoxins and so forth.
I
think his point, though, is that if we adapt some of our other technology in the nanosphere as an adjunct to nature,
right.
Then we're going to facilitate the process because it's going to be, I think, untenable for us to consider that we can use past known natural resource processes to clean up hyper-pollution functions that we are creating by the thousands per year, new chemicals.
Thank you. And this is an exploration. Because the complexity keeps going up, the time that we have keeps shrinking downward. And so is it a natural order that we actually use the tools that we currently have to match that accelerated pace? And that is exactly what I was trying to say. Thank you. So, you know, when I've talked to pioneers in the past, I mean, I know we have this controversial way of looking at things, but what's kind of, I don't want to say difficult, but kind of interesting is that there's so many different viewpoints where people sort of cling to what's familiar to them, you know, the organic world, as they call it that. And they see this as this horrible thing on the horizon line. I keep talking about belief systems, and this is where I'm probing. I'm saying that expand one's range or palette of possibilities to reorient the belief system that you wish to trust with a wider domain of knowledge. Because anytime you narrow the domain of knowledge, you invite almost irreversibly sort of going backwards rather than forwards. So I'm just trying to offer a broader panorama of tools and possible to work with. So finally, next point. The highly centralized, hard asset commodity system is decaying into irrecoverable debt vortices. We are at that event horizon, this moment. And I'm saying this not again, not because it's an interesting, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to what was said before.
Sure.
With respect to this gal who wrote Garrett.
Larry Garrett, yeah.
You know, things that were attributed by her, you know, I guess hypothetically, possibly the Gulf War syndrome was due to viruses dredged up from the desert.
That's partly it, and probably also because of vaccines.
Assertions that possibly that we're cutting further and further, you know, to create our suburbs further into you know, nature into untrammeled areas.
We're putting pressure on these things.
Very positive, you know. So we're exposing our children to all of these terrible things when, in fact, possibly we're exposing our children, you know, the pace of life and the changes of how we, our bodies are interacting with the source of sustenance and whatever. It's weakening, you know, our immune systems, just like this. And if she's willing to, you know, write it off and say, there's just all these microbes out there that we're kicking up, and where we have, it has nothing to do with certain possibly sociological, and,
Actually, I agree with you. In fact, you know, I cited her example only because it's a nice reference manual. It's like a technical manual. Say, here's the epidemiological mechanism that you observe.
I just don't agree with her 100%, mind you. And I think the two vectors operate simultaneously. That yes, because of our intrusion in natural areas, because of our changing of the environment, so on, these things now are magnified in terms of the mutational vectors. But at the same time, we are suppressing our own immune system because of the chemistries we're being exposed to, the radiation we're being exposed to, all the stuff that's going on. So both lines kind of track on a chart. I thoroughly agree with this. In fact, that's kind of where I was going to go, as a matter of fact. And as a kind of a side note, in a different kind of way, when I talk about the empathic web and all stuff, think of it like this. We live in a world now where we're bombarded with every conceivable frequency of RF that exists, from cell telephones to just radio waves in the air everywhere. We're also being blasted with 60 hertz from every direction. I mean, it's hard to find a place on the planet. You can't go and find, you know, this electromagnetic stuff sort of bombarding at the same time. We're being blasted with artificial light from all directions. Another thing this is going to be interesting is what is. It's like another kind of a challenge mechanism. And a lot of people think, well, why was it that if we did have some sort of empathic linkage to this sort of biospace around us and we all living things were connected at one point, why is it that we're not seeing this now on a more frequent basis? Well, it'd be kind of like somebody taking a 10 million candle power aircraft landing light and blasting your face and said, look at this candle. In other words, you wouldn't probably see the candle too well. In other words, we have to kind of readjust to this challenge, this test that we're being thrown with, and sort of recapture the stuff that worked in previous times, but integrate it with the tools that are currently at hand. And this is very much where I'm going to be going. So, the flip side of this coin, the resources and processes currently existing or in various stages of development, and just kind of walk down a list. Manufacture synthetic life forms, pseudomorphs, quasi-organic entities. I know it sounds scary, but, you know, we're here. So what do you do with this? Well, everybody see the movie Blade Runner? Does that sound familiar? Okay. Where this is in the year 2012, and you're walking down the main street of Los Angeles, and you have artificial life forms everywhere, and you can say, like, street corner nanotech, as it were. Well, will it go that direction? I'm not sure it'll go that far. But think of where things are at this very moment in time. I remember several years ago, I was giving a lecture. I was a member of something called the Assembly of Multitude. It was a kind of an early nanotech think tank group. And I talked about this idea of, you know, it takes about 10, it's about a 10 to 1 ratio of loss to grow a cow and then kill the cow and then cut it up so you can make meat out of it. It's a very lossy process. It's also very ecologically harmful. You have to clear-cut forests to grow more cows, and, you know, the whole thing's just kind of connected, really. And yet, it was simple, you know, to answer Mitch's question. We grew cows because it's what we knew how to do. It was the common thing. It's like anybody from anywhere on the planet knew how to grow a cow, basically. And as all of a sudden we stepped into this sort of technologically accelerated world, we simply grew more cows at the expense of the ecological systems that were being damaged because we had to keep making more than a short amount of time. So I offered the idea, I said, well, you know, if we got to a certain threshold in nanobiological development, why not just grow the snake directly? You know, like we have a machine that, in a sense, facilitates the molecules forming to get the steak out the other end. Well, in the meantime, there's been a technology called scaffolding. It's been around for a few years. And in a very simple way, what scaffolding says is you can create a three-dimensional, like a scaffold, like a structure, and there's a whole variety of materials, polyacrylamides being one of them, that are used to do this, into which you can then grow living cells. And the real ticket on this one was for creating tissue prosthetics to replace damaged organs. And right now it's been worked on liver, pancreas, for diabetes, of course, kidneys, lung tissue. There's a whole bunch of folks who are doing these kinds of experiments. In fact, I was at the Advanced Applications for Microdevices and Medicines conference 2.5 years ago, and I saw kind of the world's collection of scaffolds at that time. Well, just a few weeks ago, a guy in Germany just got his first patent for, guess what, artificial meat. And how does that work? he creates a scaffold using the same tissue synthesis technology into which they grow the cells, and he can grow not only just a steak, he can grow a designer steak that has marinade sort of, you know, in it, as it were. You fetch up the steak and say, I'm not kidding, it sounds funny, but this is like the guy's out there trying to raise capital as we speak. Well, it could be eating what it is, yeah. But I mean, the point is, it depends on the frame of reference that you look at these things. Now, if I said to somebody just down the road from here somewhere on the street, you know, 3 years from now, you're going to walk to the Safeway store and you can actually buy a steak that came out of a box, you know, some kind of a machine, the reaction might be, oh my God, how horrible, genetically modified food, this is 10 times worse. And I would say to them, no, you've actually just saved the planet's ecology from an otherwise predatory, monodirectional manufacturing system. You see where I'm going with this?
I mean, those things people would say that. What if you just scaffolded together some artificial horse product and put that in their dog food? They're going to say, no, we want our dog to eat real horse meat. You know? I mean, there's a right there to get those people.
Yeah, I know. Well, and so this is where the cultural morphology, belief system, barrier point, all that. I was sort of hoping to tie this together. Okay.
The dilemma for vegans and vegetarians when they encounter this stuff, is it animal or is it vegetable?
It's kind of like, is it memories or is it real, but taken to a sort of next scale, as it were. And I don't have an answer, I'm just saying this way.
Is it ethical vegan or is it steak out of a box?
I'm not sure. I have vegan friends who are quite fanatical. In fact, I have a couple of friends who I've known for many years. They're chief scientists at a company called Cashion. They're long time friends. And they're really serious vegans. We travel a lot, and we go to Las Vegas for Convex, and we go to all these different places for various trade shows and the like. And I've been amazed that no matter how far out or remote we are, they can find a vegan restaurant within some 50-mile radius. I mean, it's unbelievable what these guys go through. They should, like, publish some kind of manual or something. But what's interesting to me is that they really do live this. I mean, and they're wonderful people, very spiritual. I really respect them highly, but at a certain threshold point, you might be right about this. In other words, well, it's an edible thing. What is this? I mean, does it have to come out of a traditional growing situation, or can it be something that was optimized to provide the things that are most necessary and at the same time have less impact on the world? You know, and these would be just the kind of folks I would have that chat with.
Well, but I think that there's a valuable point here. I mean, it seems like we're going off on a sort of artificial meat
hand. That's all right.
I think we can use this. We can chew on this. The fact is, what are the obstacles, let's say, theoretically, to this becoming a parallel thing? You already mentioned that there's a supported market for this vegetarian reality. Somehow there's enough, and it's a small majority, but it supports the industry somehow. It's evolved that way. See, because, like, there's going to be resistance. Like, public vendors are going to say, well, we've got our cattlemen's interests at stake here, and we have to quash this new...
Exactly.
So there's going to be resistance to anything
yes.
coming from
No, that's right. No, no, you have to...
These are real interesting obstacles to the
yes.
nano,
yes.
the whole thing you've been mentioning, and others, so we can use this
yes.
as a little metaphor here. To
you hit the nail so straight in the head that the nail's a hole driven into the board.
I mean, Crosshair's target, and the target's like obliterated. You got it right 100%. When I talk about cultural morphology and belief systems, this is exactly where I'm going, and when the term disruptive technology gets used, and I hear this every day because I work in venture capital guys all the time, the first thing they talk about is, okay, this is interesting, we have an ROI of whatever, but is it disruptive? They want to know how disruptive is it.
Does
it rock the boat? And, you know, I talk to the guys who are the inner core of Intel and things like this, where they see the whole world, like, crumbling. Believe me, I mean, this is like a tip of a big iceberg. So it's a kind of a...
You pulled that metaphor out of my mind 3 seconds ahead of time, because I thought, here's the boat.
Yeah.
And you're saying, look, there's a giant iceberg ahead, and you're saying, well, don't rock the boat. We're heading back for the iceberg, but shut up.
I am actually demonstrating the empathic web as a state, so not just a joke. Okay, but thank you. I mean, clearly, I guess I'm making a connection here. So, the point I want to sort of...
You can make a cheap trip in South America.
Oh, it could be free. No, I'm serious. It could be free.
Free is altruism.
Yes, no, I understand that.
Enterprise doesn't really
mean free. And actually, I have a slide which goes into that whole economic model, which I'll get to. But I just want to walk out of the stage if I can. So, kind of where I'm hoping to steer towards this is the idea we have a potential, at least, for a distributed, granular manufacturing system, energy system, et cetera, via applied nanotechnology. Now, this isn't going to change everything overnight, but just in a kind of a broad overview, it suggests that we don't have to spend $5 billion to build a next generation computer chip factory. We don't have to go to PG and have another $1 billion spent on some giant smokestack, the power system to sort of like facilitate what we need to have our daily life. In fact, it was interesting when here at Tesla Society, forget the gentleman's name though, we had a visitor who represented sort of the inner world of the energy systems realm. And he made this wonderful comment. He said, you know, real men don't build power plants that don't have smokestacks. You know, I mean, that was a perfect snapshot because, I mean, this was a very bright guy. And he had a wonderfully beautiful knowledge of the complexity of this whole bureaucratic world that had been wrapped around this sort of hidden realm of this Machiavellian intrigue, if you will, of how power is brokered and so forth. And, I mean, it's unbelievably complex and, for the most part, it's completely unnecessary. You know, you have this whole giant system about to be sort of uprooted with this, you know, many, many years of expertise and sort of inner politics suddenly about to be challenged as if it becomes less relevant. You're right. I mean, and this is a small snapshot of a much larger, broader picture. Okay, so we have, in a sense, if I can use this term, the capacity for what I call accelerated evolution. Accelerated evolution that is being driven by the cybernetic and genetic modification of the human body. And we're here now. I mean, okay, talk about genetic foods, well, fine. We're probably the last generation, and I'm not saying this is good, I'm just saying we're probably here. We're probably the last generation, maybe our kids are the last generation, but certainly within that framework, where what we're born with is what we get. We're stepping into a territory that says we can optimize what we're being born into because the cost of health care, being an ever more regressive process, affecting the economic health of the system, has to be reversed in order for it to proceed. So here we are. I mean, that is the requirement. Synthetic sentience as a strategic resource. What do I mean by this exactly? Well, all right. Has anybody ever heard of the Global Brain Society? Is that familiar? Francis Haugen, the Global Brain Society. It's a whole bunch of computer science people and mathematicians and philosophers and all kinds of folks that sort of clump together around this nexus coordinate that says we're going to have this sort of emergent intelligence. I call it synthetic sentience. My first paper on this, by the way, was in 1997. I was at the Computational Anthropology Conference in Washington, D.C., addressing, for the most part, bureaucrats, you know, policymakers, suggesting to them that system complexity, scale, and velocity was vastly exceeding human capacity to render mission-critical decisions, compression their short time scales. They didn't necessarily want to hear this, but, you know, that's what we were presenting to them. In, I forget the exact year, everybody Out of Control by Kevin Kelly? That sounds familiar? This book came out, I think, in 95, if I'm not mistaken. I've met Kevin Kelly a few times. And he's sort of in a very general way kind of pointed at this direction. He said, you know, there's going to be this threshold where system complexity, and he used biological models, by the way, will sort of evolve to a point beyond the range of human capacity to determine the outcome of these various systems processes. That was around the same time that Michael Rothschild wrote his Bionomics book. It was also around the same time that Peter Russell wrote his Global Brain book. So there was a whole bunch of those were kind of nibbling at this event horizon, as it were, through the framework of their own reference, but they could sort of see the same picture. In a much more sort of technical sense, this Global Brain Society, founded by Francis Haugen, who runs this conference in Vienna, has attracted probably the top thinkers in the world. These are all the PhD academic types who, in a sense, ponder this kind of anthropological morphology driven by our symbiotic connection to a global scale operational ecology, that's my choice of words, out of which comes these emergent forms of intelligence. In other words, a lot of people, when they think of artificial intelligence, they think of some guy writing some code and maybe this little bot that says things and sort of behaves a certain way. Forget that. That's so archaic, not even worth going into. Instead, what's really happening is, and I can tell you this from direct knowledge because I work in this environment, the real way to approach the AI problem, it's not really a problem, it's just approaching a functionality, is to look at nature. Nature's really good. I mean, it's been doing this thing for 4 billion years. I would suggest looking at it more carefully. So what really happens in nature? Well, a baby is born. It has this very sort of open mind. It's processing everything simultaneously. And it will process what it's exposed to. And that sort of forms its knowledge base over time. It evolves an intelligence based on its experiential framework. In fact, at UCLA, there's something called the Department of Evolutionary Intelligence. And they go into great detail explaining how this process works. And if you want to get sort of a larger piece of this information, you can go to something called the Santa Fe Institute. I've been there a few times, where they have a whole department so people do nothing but grow intelligence. And I mean that quite literally. So what do you really do? Well, you create a computing platform of sorts using reconfigurable logic, and you use genetic algorithms and other forms of genetic computing processes to evolve an intelligence mechanism. Don't sit there and write little lines of code and make a talking bot. No, you sort of build a physiological mechanism out of which comes an evolved intelligence based upon what it's exposed to. And so once again, where do you find this stuff? You find it most prevalently in the biotech industry, in economic forecasting, what's called risk analysis. Insurance companies now use it to model behavior patterns. It's used in many places you would never expect it to be. But where I'm trying to get to, where I'm hoping to go, is that in a world where we have the equivalent of the Library of Alexandria hitting Gutenberg's press multiplied by a trillion, the complexity of managing that kind of knowledge, the ability to search for things of interest, goes far beyond typing in some Boolean logic and having a search engine find it for you. Now, that's ridiculous. What you have to rely upon now is a much more robust biological metaphor that looks for knowledge ontologies as they are formed by our interaction with them. So you really do have the harbingers of a self-evolving metascale emergent intelligence. And I refer to that as being a form of synthetic sentience. And by synthetic sentience, what I'm really leaning towards is the idea that an organism that is self-aware, that is self-correcting, that is defensive if necessary, that will take upon itself its own solutions to solve what it perceives as potential problems, that is a sentient organism. And the web is replete with those kinds of examples as we speak. We have privately held systems which sort of run the systems within their own framework, and they're all hooked together in this sort of gigantic web. We're at the threshold as we speak. So when I talk about the human internet symbiosis and emergent synthetic sentience and sort of working together as processes, this is exactly what I'm leaning towards. And that's a resource, not a threat, a resource. So the next thing I'd like to offer is this idea of an infinitely scalable computational resource. And by that I mean, there's a lot of stuff going out there which has to do with what's called peer-to-peer computing, process programming architecture, et cetera. But think of it like this. Several years ago, I submitted this idea that said that computing resource would no longer just be like this little box with a CPU and some memory and so on. That in fact, computers could be hooked up across the web, and that people would have the ability to brokerage access to their CPU resource, just like you can brokerage access to power. If you have a generator at home, for instance, and you plug into the grid, you can actually sell that power. As long as it complies with 60 hertz and the appropriate voltage, you can actually establish value to it. You're commoditizing this sort of virtual asset system. So I propose that at some threshold in time, in fact, I was on the board of a company, this is our model, that we could develop a system where you could brokerage processing power. Well, sure enough, there's a company called Process Street, they're based in Huntsville, Alabama, they're one of several now, where for a fee, you can walk in the door and say, look, I've got a job, let's say a rendering job for some computer animation. I can't afford to buy a giant supercomputer to do it, but I know that you guys have thousands of CPUs online, which are ready and able to facilitate this if we ask them to. So you pay a fee. Meanwhile, at the other end of the spectrum, the person who signs up for the service, they get paid micropayments. Every time their CPU is tapped, they can actually make money by having their machine idle and doing work for them on their behalf. So now you have a commoditized virtual asset. It's not a physical thing. It's not a box, but rather a web-enabled resource base that is potentially infinitely scalable. And the financial model to make this possible is not just there. It's becoming necessary to accommodate ever more robust diet for this kind of resource base. So I'm just kind of suggesting that as a start point. Because, well, actually, I've met the study online folks, and it's a very interesting question. In fact, Todd Hunter is at UC Berkeley. It's a very interesting thing because, think of it like this. These guys wanted to approach Congress to, in a sense, get grant consulting funding for an idea that nobody would actually both put money behind. In other words, nobody in Congress is going to step up to the plate and have the political courage say, yes, we put taxpayer money into trying to answer what's possibly the most important question in our existence, i.e., is there a life out there? And yet, they were faced with this incredibly difficult problem. How do we solve this? In other words, we have to scan millions and millions of specs of RF information and look for that one signature that says, aha, that was, in fact, artificially generated. This is, in my opinion, the most important thing we could possibly do. I mean, this is the top of the food chain from my perspective. And yet, what they resolved to do as an evolutionary test was beautiful. It was spectacular. It was the most lovely thing I've ever seen in my life. Because here they said, okay, fine, forget Congress. Forget a centralized, top-down, megalithic approach to solving this problem. In fact, let's reverse the trend completely. Let's distribute it in a highly granular, distributed fashion where nobody owns anything. In fact, we can take advantage of an existing resource and apply it accordingly. And furthermore, now that they solve a technical problem, they also instigated a cultural morphology. They got lots and lots of people from different walks of life, from the various areas, to sort of converge on this common idea of, hey, I can participate, I can kind of think a little bit further, I can actually consider this idea as being real, and it doesn't even cost me anything. And as a snapshot, as a kind of a glimpse as to where this kind of thinking might go, that was a wonderful example. And that's an example I often refer to myself. So the next...
Something here you might not be familiar exactly, but with the example that I cited and you vendors here, so maybe you can just mention for the people. I don't know, who here is not familiar with the Teddy distributed programming system?
Okay, and in fact, they have it here at MJ Consulting. Real history. All it is you download a piece of software. It takes a huge amount of computing power to analyze spectrographically RF information from out there. It's a mathematical challenge. So it would take a lot of computing research to do this. So the theory is you download this piece of software like a screensaver, and then when you're not using a computer for something active, it automatically grabs a chunk of data and will process it, form a sort of a micro scale technique on it, and then it'll post it back to the central server. So they can now use a whole collection of distributed computing from anywhere on the planet that can be internet connected, and in a sense have this sort of supercomputer capacity. It's batch mode process, but it still solves the problem.
Charles, would you say the flip side of this is something like Napster?
You know, I've had this question a few times. And the thing is, media streaming is a kind of a start point, does in a sense kind of popularize the concept of process streaming. And in process streaming, which is I think where we're going to be going with this, it's not so much can I download a song or can I get a piece of a movie or whatever. That's like a public service veneer for a much more robust process streaming capacity. But in a sense, I understand where you're going. It's kind of like a market model. It kind of opens the door to say, oh, I never thought about that, but how interesting. In other words, it's one thing for me to have written a paper 5 years ago that I discussed this theoretically, but something very different to have the general population of teenage kids go, gee, I had no idea this could be done. So it kind of sets a tone, if you will, to make this a more publicly understandable concept. But the next thing I want to go towards is this mind-machine interface, because I think this is like this next big ticket we're about to cross into. And I want to kind of illuminate a couple of ideas. In 1989, the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base actually initiated a series of experiments. I mean, how many folks saw the film Firefox? Is that familiar? Where the guy steals a Russian plane and he thinks the commands can find. And how many folks have seen the film Brainstorm? Okay. Brainstorm actually came out in the mid-80s, which I thought was really ahead of its time. But the basic concept was you could, in a sense, store the experiential knowledge of the person's moment in time, put them into an optical storage medium, and then sort of play it back to somebody else, you know, through this mind-machine interface. Well, we haven't quite gotten there yet. That's still a little bit ways away. But we're sort of almost there, and let me explain why I say that. Because in the late 80s, early 90s, both the Soviets and the U.S. were particularly focused on pilots, the purpose being that the high-performance aircraft, the performance was exceeding the human's performance capacity to respond under pulling 8, 9 Gs, and you have to scan the skyline, you have to scan the panel, you have to go through all this procedure, and the time it takes to cognize, to contextually cognize some process and then like activate a button, that 100 milliseconds or so, if they could take that out of the loop, that buys another, you know, half a G's worth of capacity for the pilot. So I thought, okay, great, is there a way to, in a sense, measure these electrochemical signatures, which are up here, and translate that into control messages so you could actually think a command and the system would know about it? Sure, it can be done. And in fact, there's something called a squid detector, a super quantum interference device, which in a sense is so sensitive to extremely tiny changes in voltage and current that one can differentiate the particular signature of a particular thought. And I'm going to parallel this a little bit because NIH, National Institute of Health, also has had a program going on for several years, headed by Dr. Terry Hembrick, somebody I've known for some time, where a bunch of the major schools, medical schools throughout the country, they use a highly specialized version of an NMR camera, neutral magnetic resonance camera, to in a sense take a volumetric snapshot of a person's brain while they're solving complex word problems or looking at some kind of audiovisual stimulus. They had a whole series of controls and where they would say, okay, here's the procedure. You know, we're now going to expose you to the NMR camera and we're going to watch what your brain does while you're going through this process. Over the years, thousands of these samples have been taken to the point where they could differentiate between individuals what signatures were unique versus which ones were common for different kinds of states of mind, mental process, etc. the whole point being that if you sort of look at that, and then you look at the ability to actually have a SCID system measure what happens in here and use that as a control mechanism, and once again, 89, the experiment I saw at the time was they had a guy strapped in a gurney like this, and hovering over his head was this 55-gallon drum full of, you know, liquid helium with a superconducting device inside. But they got as far as the guy could think a word, like left, right, up, down, or think a color, you know, orange, green, blue, etc., and it worked. They actually could get this. Now, if you look at nanotechnology for a moment, as a material science, once again, and you look at superconductivity as a process facilitated by that kind of molecular scale fabrication in materials, my machine interface isn't that far off at all. In fact, it gets to the point where it becomes almost a consumer item at a certain threshold. And whereas people think today in terms of going to the computer, typing something in, having the web search system go find some information, forget that. What about you think of an idea? And meanwhile, in the background, you have this biological metaphor in computing, sort of artificial intelligence engine that's part of your personal footprint in that world that kind of understands what you're thinking about and continuously updates your interaction with the resource base out there. That's what I see maybe a handful of years from now, if it's allowed to be used in that context. Now, the reason I kind of bring that up is because, once again, the scale, velocity, complexity of knowledge requirement to function in today's world and what is going to become even more so in the future requires this kind of empathic interaction to an ever-scaled higher degree of knowledge requirement to simply tread water, let alone accelerate or do something unique. In other words, the pressure that's placed upon people today, if they're going to be doing something in the business world or the science world, you can't just learn one little thing and that's all you know about and that's what you do. It doesn't work that way anymore. Most people, in fact, I really feel strongly about this, most people in school today, the whole vision of what life had been, where you learn a subject, you get your degree, you go work at some company for 25 years and retire, that's gone. That's long gone. Nowadays, people are pressured ever more to learn maybe 10 different subjects eventually over time. They might switch jobs 10 times or more. They might have a whole series of collection of different job types all sort of mixed together. In the systems I now look at in the biological world, that's exactly what's happening. You have these biotech firms where it really is just that. And the pressure that's placed upon people to optimize the knowledge management in these very complex situations, they're pushed right to the very edge of what's possible. So are we going to be at a new frontier that says my machine interface and the sort of reliance upon this operational ecology to which we are now adapted, it's no longer an option. It's the single requirement that makes this even function at all. How far away is that timeline? Could be 10 years or 15 or something. You know, if a certain collection of trends continue to migrate in that direction. I'm just saying as a framework to look at our evolutionary threshold point, this moment in time, does the mind machine interface component become a serious, irreversible threshold? It could. I just offer this as an idea. So that, in fact, is what facilitates the human internet symbiosis that's needed to come to pass. Last two items would be distributed virtual asset commodity systems, which I sort of discussed earlier, and this whole idea of knowledge conveyance as an experiential process, that's kind of what I'm leaning towards. In other words, again, in a previous framework, you would read a book, understand its content, read some more books, understand its content. Maybe in an academic setting, you would like take a test and survive it and forget 90% of what you just learned. You know, that's a typical procedure. Well, that may not be so relevant in the future world.
Can you expand a bit on the next of the last
Well, it is. Well, actually, the word conscience fits rather well. The whole point is that the valuation is not in the physical commodity. The valuation is in the process. And if you take this to its ultimate extreme, maybe 20 years from now or something, if the sort of Drexlerian nano world somehow comes to life, which it might or might not, I'm not sure. But let's just say you get to a certain threshold where you don't just grow a steak, you grow whatever it is you want. Or you have a localized manufacturer that says, at the point of inception, you simply fabricate the thing you're interested in because it's there. You don't have to go to some giant factory off halfway around the planet and have this incredibly complex supply chain to make this one thing possible. You can sort of just fabricate it as you need to at a moment in time. So is the value in the hard object? No, it's not. The object's a throwaway. It's free. The process that enabled it, though. And so how do you translate a fiduciary system, if you will, which is not based on the physical gadget thing, but on the process that made it possible, that's where the question mark comes in. And I've drawn up a series of charts and graphs and presented. I was at Duke University last year, the Food Law School of Business. This is one of the most conservative business schools on the planet. I mean, I go to Haas over at Berkeley and blather on about this stuff, and people say, okay, it's interesting. But at Duke, you know, it's a little more serious. You feel like you're really stepping into kind of a precarious realm there. And yet, you know, this was a very, very serious top-level sort of management group that I was talking to. And about half of them said, yeah, I think you're actually kind of loose partially. We see this trend. We know that at a certain threshold, the knowledge ontologies actually are the core value. When we invest in a company, let's say, be it a biotech firm or whatever, they may have a bunch of proteins and some molecules they invented, but in fact, it's the knowledge ontology that actually is what carries the investment value into the next stage of development. So we're kind of at the edge of this. I'm just saying, as a kind of, it's kind of like when you're driving to Las Vegas, from 50 miles out, you can see the glow. You can't quite see the lights yet, but you can see the glow. So we're like seeing the glow, as it were, and that's kind of what we're going to see. All right. So this is kind of a complicated chart, and we don't necessarily have to. And by the way, I don't know what the time frame is, but anytime you feel like we should have a break, just yell and we can take a break or something. But I kind of wanted to have this one chance to show this chart, because I think these are the important things to know about, at least in my opinion. So if you look at our past realm, this is where we were. We were in this whole idea of a fixed material resource-based, hard asset commodities, traditional biomedical resources, and so on. And if we stay there, and this last one, of course, is the most important, the geographic confined resource allocation. That is, you have to go to country X and dig a hole in the ground, pull out its minerals or whatever it is. If we stay there, we go into regression. We might as well just throw in the towel, because we're not going to get any further. So at the present, we're here. We have this sort of collection of tools here. We have nanotech, we have this sort of artificial life, biological metaphors, computing metaphor. We have the internet as a delivery platform. We have the human internet symbiosis. And we have this conversion, if you will, to a virtual asset commodity economic system. I'm not saying we're there quite yet, but we're sort of nibbling at the edge of this process. So where might it go? Maybe, possibly, if a certain node in the chart sort of get pushed in a certain direction. We could end up here.
Virtual asset commodities, is that kind of representative of faith in the system?
Actually, it's representing in the process carrying the value as opposed to the physical material. And I use the biotech industry because that's a very good, clear, and current example of this. And like I said, if you walk into the front door of any of these major companies, the stuff in the test tube isn't where the value is. The stuff in their knowledge ontology, that's where the actual valuation, I mean, when a venture capital entity walks through the door and says, we want to invest in company X, they actually look at the knowledge ontology as being the first and primary thing of value. Because the technology itself, the physical stuff, is in a sort of state of professional change, and its rate of change keeps continuing upward. In other words, I may have a wonderful molecule at this moment that allows for the cure of something or another, but if I don't have a knowledge ontology where I can simulate the physiological mechanisms, sort of evolve new molecule types and so on, if there isn't a histrionic into the future that says that my knowledge base is going to push this process, there's probably no investment value there. And that's kind of where we're at this moment in time. So it's kind of a theoretical one. I'm saying, if you walk down this path a little bit, and you look at the sort of nanotech-driven economies of the future, where it's ever more reliant upon, not can I make this gadget here, but rather do I have an interesting software system of sorts to facilitate manufacture anywhere on the planet, that's where you get into this virtual commodity asset sort of architecture. So where I want to go with this is sort of looking at this log chart. This is a logarithmic time chart. And if you're just pushing forward in time a little bit, as I see it to be, this is my opinion, but as I see it to be, these are these evolutionary seminal marking points. And we're right about here, actually. We're looking at this sort of real-time connected economic ecology, this human internet symbiosis, we have this compounding multiplier effect. These are all synergistic codependence, and they sort of magnify each other's process. And we're at the edge of this, the synthetic sentience threshold, and of course, the sort of collective sentience operational xenomorph, as I call it. And a xenomorph, by the way, just in case you're curious, what a xenomorph really is, how many people saw the film The Thing? Carpenter's, okay. And the basic premise was he had an organism which could sort of decompose and recompose itself on the fly to suit some ecological or environmental perception. That's what a xenomorph is. So in a sense, we as a species are kind of creating this virtual ecology, if you want to call it that, which in itself is xenomorphic by nature. That is, it's reconstructing itself and sort of reorganizing to suit our stimulus, you know, prodding the system to extract from it the processes that are of most value at a given point in time. So in a sense, we are creating a sort of operational xenomorph as a platform. So the thing I kind of really lean towards is the whole idea, you've heard the term convergence, and it's kind of a buzzword, and people talk about digital convergence. They think of, like, you know, web pages suddenly delivering TV, and how boring. But what it really represents is process convergence. That's, to me, where it's more interesting. Because really the stuff of process convergence is bits, atoms, and genes. We have the bits as the knowledge mechanism, as it were. We have the atoms as the physical material. And we have the genes, not only to represent us as a living thing, but also as the computational processes, which are becoming themselves ever more genetically dependent. They actually use genetic algorithms to solve the problem that otherwise couldn't be solved. And by, I'll go back to this picture, by the way, this strangling chart. That's actually a real chart. This actually comes from an in silico biology representation of a cell. And this is like one of many, by the way, but there's a whole collection of these systems which are out there as we speak, which says that a person in the biotech, biopharma, proteomics world, this is what they look at as a way to kind of chart out where they might be going for the next proteom solution for whatever they're trying to engineer.
It's actually a genetic thing, there's a potential for...
Yes, that's
cellular
yeah, that's exactly what we're looking at.
I mean, what is that?
Would it represent both of the complex and other with mitochondria? Exactly. You have your mitochondria and your proteasomes and your ribosomes and that whole, you know, cytoplasm and all that. And, okay, so on this threshold, with everybody's brain probably hurting at the moment, I think we should all take a pause and we'll come back to this. Right.
Thank you.